Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Hannah Rossner. Hannah is amazingly an amazing director of a movie that's just come out, a mockumentary called Park City. We'll be talking with her about that, but she's also an author. At age 15, she wrote a novel and got it published at age 16. We're now talking with Hannah Rossner, With Respect. We'll be right back. Hannah, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. All right. Everybody starts off with this. Hannah, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Bridgman, Michigan.
Yeah?
That's right. I was born in St. Joseph, and I lived here until I was 18.
All right. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Bridgman Middle School and High School. I actually went somewhere in Maryland for elementary school, and then when I graduated, I went to Columbia College in Chicago.
That's the College of Arts and Science, or Arts and...
Primarily Arts. It's a liberal arts school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've had the... now he's the former CEO, the ex-CEO, pardon me, chairman of the board.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Turner has been on our program several times.
Oh, great.
So, Anna, what got you into movies, for pity's sakes?
Well, I don't know. I think it was just kind of the only thing I ever really wanted to do. I started seeing lots of films when I was younger with my mom. She took me to see Contact and Titanic, and I loved just seeing films on the big screen. And I, for a while, entertained the idea of being an actress, but then I figured out that I had a lot more choices and a lot more control if I was on the other side of the camera. So I decided I wanted to be a director, and so I went to film school, and here I am.
Well, you know, it's funny. I did a pilot for a TV show, for a version of this show. And in the process of doing that, I found out just exactly what you mean. You know, I'm used to being in control on my show. When I went on to the TV side, I had a cameraman telling me what to do. I had a director telling me what to do. And I had a sound man telling me what to do. And I lost control.
Mm-hmm.
It was them.
It's the best part of being a director. You tell everybody what to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's really I would work on a lot of sets in college. I would, you know, go be the hold the boom mic, or, you know, help the set decorators or whatever it is. And it wasn't until I started directing, I was like, this is cool.
This is neat.
This is the best. Yeah. This is, you tell everybody what to do, and it's all about your vision, and everyone works together. It's not completely like, I'm not a dictator. I don't just say, you do that, and I don't listen to anyone.
Right, you now know. You aren't, but wait until
that's true.
Your 23rd movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to do what?
Yeah.
No, you not.
Yeah.
All right, Anna, tell me about your family. Where are they? What are they composed of, and, you know, where are they from?
Well, my family's originally from Des Plaines, Illinois. My parents met in college at U of I. I'm wearing their sweatshirt right now. You can't see that. But they raised me in Michigan, and right now my dad is working in Minneapolis. He's going to be home this weekend. He is a contractor for nuclear power plants, so he's the more analytical, smart one. In that, my mom is incredibly smart, but in a different way.
Yeah.
And then she's an artist and a yoga instructor, and she's been a huge inspiration in my life. A photographer, illustrator, she does it all. Writer, excellent writer. And then I have a little brother, Dylan, who lives in Huntington Beach, California, which is about an hour south of me. So I get to see him every once in a while, which is great. And he is also a musician, so makes some electronic music. He's very talented. So,
well, you know, I've met your brother,
and
he's little is just only an age.
Little as in younger. He's very tall and intimidating.
Yeah. But and I met your dad and mom. Your mom has been on our show talking about autism, mm-hmm. and has been just an extraordinary, given me a lot of information about autism and from all different aspects, and just an amazing person. So I enjoyed having her on the show three times, which is unusual for
That's
us.
Great.
Now, you started in the Bridgman schools. At some point, you decided to start writing.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I don't know that I ever really decided. I've been writing my whole life. I think since I could hold a pen and paper, I've been writing stories. And, you know, when I was a kid, I would kind of be the ringleader of the group in terms of, like, this is what we're going to – today we're on a pirate ship, and you're, you know, you're going to walk the plank. And that was always me. So I was kind of – I've been a storyteller, I think, my whole life. And I think – you know, I would write books. I'd start writing like the new Star Wars sequel, but, you know, I wouldn't ever finish anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was about when I was 14, 15, I decided I wanted to write this book. And I just, I don't know how I had time. I had less time in high school than I've ever had in terms of, I was just in every extracurricular activity. I was in a play. I was in two sports. And I was going to school. But I would write, you know, on a napkin or on the back of my planner or whenever I had a free moment. And it was fun. It was like a completely different world than the life I was living. So I basically, you know, finished that novel in a matter of a few months and just decided maybe I can get this published. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty relentlessly ambitious as a teenager. So,
as opposed to now.
Yeah. Well, you know, now I sometimes get into things. The movie was the same way. I mean, we can get into that later. But mm-hmm. sometimes I get into things not really knowing how difficult it's going to be and how many obstacles there are going to be mm-hmm. and how the odds are against you. And if you do know that going in, you probably won't do it. Mm-hmm. You probably will be mm-hmm. too discouraged. So
That's
everything
right.
I've done, I just go into it with abandon. You know, I don't look back.
Mm-hmm.
So
I had an assistant prosecutor work with me, an assistant U.S. attorney. She became an assistant U.S. attorney and now she's a judge. And one of the things she told me was this. I kept inviting her, hey, come on back, let's go back to Berrien for the law enforcement dinners and law enforcement programs. And she said, John, I really don't want to do that. Why? Because I move forward.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I had a great time doing what I did.
Right.
But moving forward is more a better use of my time.
Right. It's very important. And you got to know what you're doing. And so after I got the book published, I did write another book, but pursuing a career as an author didn't seem, while I love to write, it seemed like you can write a book anytime, anywhere. I wanted to move to Hollywood and I wanted to write movies. And, you know, not that continuing to write books wouldn't be moving forward, but just for me, I felt like I just had to keep pushing myself as mm-hmm. far as I could go and keep challenging myself. And so getting into the movie business was definitely the biggest challenge I've ever faced, or maybe ever will in my life.
Why?
Because there is a lot of competition, and everyone's like you in terms of there's a lot of people from a small town who maybe, you know, had a lot of success as a person in a small town, and then when they get to Hollywood, they could get lost in the shuffle. There's mm-hmm. so many people trying to do exactly what you're doing, and there's really only a handful of successful story creatives. And to try and be one of those people, you have to be the hardest worker. You have to be first in, you know, to your job and last to leave, and you have to really, really shine and really make yourself known. And there's just so much to learn. It's very overwhelming when you first undertake, you know, the challenge of trying to break into the film business. But it helps to know people and have people that are supportive, but you really have to believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back for a minute. You actually got your first book published,
mm-hmm.
And is it available? I mean, is it still out there?
Yeah. You can find it on Amazon.com. You can order it online. It's easiest to find through the publisher's website, which is PublishAmerica.com. PublishAmerica mm-hmm. is the name of the company that published it. It's not necessary. You won't find it on the shelves, but you can have the bookstore mm-hmm. order it.
All right.
Which is pretty cool.
Now, the name of the book, we better have a name for
yes,
this book.
Yes, yes. The book is called The Ambulance Club.
All right. What is it about?
It's about a group of teenage girls. It's actually about a girl who moves to Laurel Canyon, which is now where I live. I had never been there. She moves to Laurel Canyon. She's 16. She's trying to make some friends, and she kind of falls into this group of anarchist Catholic schoolgirls. No one knows how ruthless they are, but really, you know, they seem like the popular girls. They get all the guys' attention, but they're always pulling pranks, and they're kind of pushing the boundaries as far as they can go. And so Mallory, the main character, gets into it just because she wants to be liked and get through her last year of school, and ends up really getting sucked into this this kind of dark world that she's never seen anything like it before, and has to find a way out. So it becomes a thriller. It kind of starts as a teen drama, which becomes more of a darker thriller. Mm-hmm. So
how long did it take you to write it?
A couple of months, maybe 6 months. It's not a long book. It's about 100 pages, but it's definitely, you know, young adult fiction. So I always hoped it would catch on with, you know, like the Twilight crowd, I suppose. But there's no vampires in it.
Oh,
so, well, unfortunately.
Well, come on.
Sorry.
You were behind your time or ahead of your time or something. I don't know what.
Yeah. There was a couple of similar books and films came out a couple of years after within the time that I wrote the book. That was.
Could you explain to me? I mean, I understand when I was growing up, we used to watch these horror movies and. Great, whatever. But why is it so? Are they so popular? And all right, first of all, vampires, Frankenstein, and zombies.
Right.
All right.
Well,
yeah, and aliens, space aliens.
I can't explain the zombies. That's a whole, you know, we might get into some sort of socioeconomic discussion with the zombies. But the vampires, the Twilight thing, I figured it out. I could not figure it out because I wasn't into those books. But it's about forbidden romance, and that has always been a popular topic among, you know, people who love stories, people who love romance and fiction, because, you know, for a long period of time, it was class that separated people. So you would have love stories about, you know, warring families who, you know, Romeo and Juliet is a classic mm-hmm. forbidden love story. And then you would have stories where, you know, the woman was from a higher class and the man was of a lower class, since they weren't allowed to be together, and it was so tragic, and that's always been popular with especially young women. And now that's not really an issue anymore so much, or race, you know, at least in our society, a lot of those boundaries have been pulled down. But if a guy is a vampire and he kind of wants to eat you as badly mm-hmm. as he wants to kiss you, that's mm-hmm. forbidden romance. So mm-hmm. I think that's where the fascination might come in.
Well, you know, that's actually the best description I have heard about that in my whole, I have never, ever, ever been able to figure that out. And you've now answered probably something else, which is the 50 Shades of Grey.
Right.
Same thing.
Right.
And I was talking to a woman who is doing a screenplay about a case of ours, and this was just when this 50 Shades of Grey came out. I said, what is this? And she said, I have never seen it, but I have a theory, and I will be happy to exchange a theory, but I will not discuss the book. At any rate, but it is interesting to me how there are continuing themes which keep popping up in literature. Bram Stoker,
right.
Frankenstein,
right.
and whatnot. I had a chance to interview Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl.
Yes,
and
Great book.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh,
I read her prior books.
Excellent.
And I asked her, after I read this book, I thought, this is a strange book.
Mm-hmm.
There's strange characters.
Yeah.
So I said, Gillian, why? Why did you write this? And she said, ever since I was a little girl, I wanted to scare myself.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
She said, I just like to scare myself.
It's hard to scare people these days. It's hard to really really surprise people, I think. They've seen everything, you know? You've got like, I worked not closely with, but I worked in proximity of Sacha Baron Cohen, who directed, you know, The Dictator and Borat. And, you know, he's done everything. He's pushed all the boundaries, and it's really hard to shock people. So you got to really figure out what scares you, or what makes you laugh out loud, or what makes you cry, and try to, evoke that in others with your work. So, but that's, you're right. That's a really good point. If she tried to scare it.
Yeah.
She wanted to scare herself.
We're talking to Hannah Rossner, who is the director and actor and screenwriter of a mockumentary, which was shown recently at the Vickers Theater called Park City, and we'll be talking more about that later. This is With Respect, and my name is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Hannah Rossner, who is a director, writer, novelist, multi-talented person, whose mockumentary, Park City, was recently shown at the Vickers Theater and is going national. This is John Smetanka. Now, Hannah, all right, let's get to the Park City. Because this is, first of all, this is not your first venture into making films.
Right.
Tell them about that. What else did you have?
Well, I've shot a couple other short films. I did a film in college called I'll Be Your Sailor, which was based on a short story by Joe Mino, who's actually a famous writer from Chicago, novelist, and also a teacher at Columbia. I believe he still is a professor at Columbia. Got to meet him. That film did the festival circuit for a bit. It was just a short. Did another film called Homemade, which was about about a little girl who just wanted to fit in. Then I did a couple of music videos in the last few years, and some spec commercials that I shot. One of the music videos was called Lisa, Lisa, Lisa. The song is called Lisa, Lisa, Lisa. It's by the band Yellow Alex. That was all one take. That music video was all just one continuous shot,
mm-hmm.
Which was very, very cool. But Park City is my first feature film.
What got you into doing that?
I went to film school, Columbia, and when I moved to LA, I just started mostly working in industry jobs that aren't always as production-based. In college, I did a lot of work on shoots or in post-production houses, and once I got to Hollywood, I wanted to work for a studio. So I had a couple of internships, and I had one job as a post PA, which a PA is like the person production assistant, right, that runs around. All I did was drive around with hard drives, and but it was cool. I'd go to the Warner Brothers lot. I really got to know the town that way. And then after a few months of working for a screenwriter, I somehow got it in my head that I had time to make a feature film. And because what happened was my friend Dave and I, Dave Hoffman, who's in one of the leads in Park City, we decided one day at the very last minute to drive to Sundance. And we had like $100 and we didn't really know anyone. We knew a couple people that were screening their films. And I said, let's just go. I've always wanted to go to Sundance. It's supposed to be so cool. And we had no idea what we were in for. We just got into a lot of very random adventures, met some people. We met Bill Murray, which was very exciting. And when we got back to L.A., we would tell everyone the story about our trip to Sundance and all the little hijinks we got into. And so the next year, Sundance was quickly approaching, and I said, we should go back to Sundance and make a documentary. We should just film our experience there. And then somebody had the idea. I think it was my friend Mike, who's one of my mentors, actually, Mike Chamoy, had the idea that it should be like a narrative and that we should give it a storyline. And, every movie has a simple premise. This one was, a couple of filmmakers go to Sundance to screen their film, but they lose their film print the night before their screening.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a similar structure to like The Hangover or any of those movies where, like, you know, what happened last night? We got to retrace our steps to find the crucial MacGuffin, in this case, the movie. And
oh, come on. Tell me. I love that you used the word the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to tell our audience the MacGuffin.
The MacGuffin is whatever the protagonist, the main character of the film, is looking for, whatever they're seeking. So, and, you know, I think it was the rabbit's foot in one of the Mission Impossible movies, and, you know, or it's the notebook, or it's...
Do you know who came up with the MacGuffin?
I do, but I can't remember. Who was
Alfred
it?
Hitchcock.
Yes.
He came up with it because, just for what you said. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that they're looking for.
Right, what they need. Yeah, it's literally the object. So in this movie, our MacGuffin is the film, which was a little ridiculous because they don't need to actually screen film on a 35mm reel, but, you know, it was very important that they find this thing. So anyway, so we had this idea for the movie, and I wrote a script with my best friend Julia Turner, who's a very, very talented writer, absolutely hilarious, the funniest person I've ever met, and just a great writer. And she and I would pass the script back and forth. I mean, we were sitting at our desks. We were interns at the same time, and we would, you know, come up with ideas over Gmail chat. I'd say, what do you think about this? What if they go, you know, what if they lose the film print and it's been at the house the whole time? And she's like, oh, that's pretty good. All right. And so we just passed the script back and forth. And a lot of the great lines are hers. A lot of the great lines are mine. And a lot of the great lines were completely improvised on the scene. So, yeah. So anyway, so once we had the script, we were like, this is actually really funny. I mean, we did like a round table read where we got all the actors over to my house and we all read the script all the way through. And Julia read all the action lines that aren't actually in the script or in the movie. And we were just dying laughing. We were like, this is really funny. We gotta shoot this. So we went to Park City, drove up for 4 days there and back. It was a harrowing adventure in terms of just bad weather and not really knowing where we were all going to stay. We stayed. We couch surfed with a very nice man named Phidias, who lived in Salt Lake City. Crashed on his floor, and when we came back from Park City, we didn't really have enough footage for a whole movie. In fact, we probably only had enough footage for about a fifth of the movie. Mm. And a lot of those scenes that we shot up on the drive up just got thrown out because we were like, we can do with this much better. So we reshot some of it, but some of it we kept. And then over the course of the next year, we shot every weekend or every other weekend because we all had day jobs. And we're cutting the movie in between scenes we were shooting. So that was about 6 months of, you know, a couple days here and there of shooting, probably about 22 total shooting days. And then we had a movie. So just, you know, cut it, did the sound, did the music.
Now, the movie, you talked about the 35 millimeter.
Yeah.
And that is what traditionally people have grown up with over the past, 40 years, 50 years.
Right.
That isn't what films are made of these days. It certainly is
sometimes
not what yours.
Sometimes there's a lot of studio movies, they do still shoot on film, but for the most part, it's more and more being shot on digital. It's very expensive to shoot on film. Film costs them a lot of money, and because it's less prevalent, there's processing fees. There's a lot. It's just more expensive to get a film, like actual film, made and shot. To have everything on digital is
okay. Cheap. We have 8mm, which started. That's what the home films were in the old days.
Right.
And then it got you. If you really got professional, you went up to 16mm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I started shooting on.
Is it
16,
was okay. Yeah. Now then it was 35, and that's what traditionally I think movies were made for 50 years.
Right.
Now, my question is about that is when did digital come in, and how different is it to shoot a movie from 35, the equipment, the perspective, the timing, all of that, to a digital? Is there a difference?
Absolutely. And one of the main differences, at least from a directorial point of view, is that when you have film, you have to be incredibly deliberate about all of your choices. Not saying you shouldn't be with digital, but you have a lot more freedom with digital to say, oh, well, we can shoot all day long. You know, we just, it's all on a card. You know, all of the digital video that we're shooting is going to end up on a computer. So we've got plenty of space for that. So we got all day. Take your time. Do as many takes as you need. You know, and in a way, you have more freedom, but it also can be limiting because you don't have to make, like I said, such deliberate choices. Whereas when you're making a film, you've got 400, well, not 400 feet, but you know, you have a couple thousand feet of film, and you know, however many seconds, maybe 6 minutes or 12 minutes. Where you got to get this shot before, you know, your light is going to change, and everything just has to be precise. Everything, you know, all the mise-en-scene, which is everything in mm-hmm. the scene, has got to be exactly as it needs to be. And you really want to get those performances right on the first couple tries, because you really don't have as much film. You know, if you have lots of money, I guess you can use as much film as you want. But for most filmmakers, especially starting out, you would prefer to shoot on digital when you got all the time you need, mm-hmm. and you can change a lot of things, you know, right in the camera, or make adjustments that are just a bit easier than working with a film camera. And also your footage is right there. You don't need to take it to the lab. Mm-hmm. You don't need to get it digitized. You don't need to get it processed. So you also have a little bit more freedom in how you can manipulate your film in post. And I've learned how to shoot on film, which was, I thought, something really great that Columbia did. I think more and more they're switching to digital as well, just in their curriculum. But it was a valuable experience being able to just to have the constraints and have the limitations. I think limitations are the best thing for a creative person.
Mm.
So
why?
Because it forces you to. I don't want to keep saying think deliberately, but really that's the best way to put it. It really forces you to make sure that all of your choices are informed, and that you've had to put a lot more effort and thought, because you don't have, you know, there's some films that I've seen that have been made for $7,000 and they're brilliant. I mean, Primer is an example. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, but it's a brilliant film. It was Shane Carruth, his first film, and it's a bit abstract. I mean, it's very abstract in its subject matter, but they made it for $7,000 and they really had to make it count. So, mm-hmm. you know, all the effects, they, you know, are very, you know, precise. Whereas, you know, in a multi-million-dollar Hollywood movie, they don't seem to be as creative. And, you know, some people don't really know why that is. And it's not a lack of vision from the director necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just, well, we've got all these actors to take care of and so many people on mm-hmm, set, and it's just, mm-hmm. it can be madness. And there's just really not as many, there's not the same limitations that you have when you're making a small budget film. Mm-hmm. So
when I go to the movies, and I've done that for years, that's a thing in our family, we like it. But I've noticed a transformation in the kind of shooting that takes place, where now seem to be, back in the oldest movies, the 20s, 30s, 40s, you see more set shots. That is, the camera is fixed and you move from place to place, but it's with separate pictures, mm-hmm. separate, I don't even know what the technical term is, but if you're looking at a person's face, and they're a part of a conversation, the camera doesn't move, the face may move and,
right.
and interpret. But then if you wanted the other part of the conversation, you flip over and you do a second shot mm-hmm. on the other person of the conversation. Again, fixed.
Right.
Now I see many more movies in which the camera jumps around. Mm-hmm. It is moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, sometimes I think it's very distracting. Other times it works. It gives some real life. But what
you mean
you
that
did
there's
some of that.
That there's more handheld shots?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of become popular, just I think even more so in the last 10 years, especially with a lot of the popularity of a lot of found footage films, starting with, you know, Blair Witch Project. And
oh, start me on that.
Yeah.
Start me on
We'll get back to that.
Yeah.
Gotcha. But films like that, this whole found footage phenomenon, it happened around the same time that reality television became popular. I think people were just like, I want to watch something as close to reality as possible, which is silly because reality TV is completely scripted.
Right.
Or just, you know, people, they only cut the interesting stuff, which I don't find interesting. But, you know, back to handheld camera, I think that what that's all about is it really puts you in the action. Sometimes I do find it distracting. I've watched some handheld films recently where I'm like, just put it on a tripod. God, I'm just sick.
Yes, please.
All the movement. Yeah.
I'm getting seasick here.
Yeah, you really have to have a talented camera person to to operate. And I personally thought that our operators did a great job. It was mostly Megan Boundy, our cinematographer. And it can be just a practical thing. You don't have as much time to shoot. You're kind of on the move. And so if you just put it on your shoulders instead of on sticks, you know, on the tripod, you got more freedom to follow the actors. You don't really have to plan your shot so much, which we hardly ever planned. We didn't do a lot of shot lists. We just kind of, which gave it more of the improvisational vibe. And so the reason you see a lot of handheld TV, you know, like with The Office, that gives it this improvisational vibe. I mean, they are improvising a lot of their lines, but it also makes it feel like you're right there, and these people are so quick with their jokes. And there's just something about like zooming in on the, you know, on the person's face at that moment instead of cutting to a closer shot that really makes you feel closer to the action and makes you feel closer to the characters.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Hannah Rossner, who is the director, actor, screenwriter, chief cook, and bottle washer for the mockumentary Park City. This is John Smetanka. We're talking on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Hannah Rossner, who is the producer, innovator, writer, songwriter, whatever, for the movie, the mockumentary, a full-length movie called Park City, recently shown at the Vickers Theater in Three Oaks. But I have a question for you. I saw the Blair Witch Project. And I read the hype before that. I thought it was, I can't use the word on radio, it was awful.
Yeah.
I really didn't like
it. It's not a good movie.
It's not a good movie, but they've got this wonderful play when it's Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine.
Yeah.
And people flock to the theaters. And it's, you know, you go to a movie, it's like reading a book that is very popular. And you think it's garbage, but you're afraid to say it because, everybody else must like it.
Yeah.
That's the value of the publicity angle and it's the right place at the right time angle.
I try to see films before hearing the hype, which is very difficult in the Twitter age. But I really try to get to a movie. I'll often see a movie at midnight, even if I am not that excited about it, even if I don't think it's going to be that great. If I know it's going to be newsworthy, it's going to be making headlines, if people have been talking about it before it comes out, I try to see it midnight on Thursday or whenever it, as soon as it comes out, so that I don't get to hear all the word of mouth, because that can often ruin it, because you know, you have all this enthusiasm to see a film and then people lower your expectations and then you go in thinking it's going to be bad, or they raise your expectations and you go in thinking it's better than it turns out to be. And going to the movies is a completely personal experience. So there, other people's opinions can color your own opinion, but for the most part, some people like movies, some people hate that same movie. You really never know what it's going to be. So back to Blair Witch, or films like that where you're like, well, what's the big deal? What's so impressive about that? I've seen so many films that I'm just like, what's all this hype about? But when something is new, regardless of if it's actually quality, you know, mm-hmm. if it's good performances or if it's, you know, what we traditionally think of as, you know, the aspects of a great film, if it's new and people can then, a lot of studios, I think, can capitalize on something like Blair Witch because they made it for no money. Mm-hmm. And so right now you've got, I'm going to butcher his name, but I think it's Oren Peli, the director of Paranormal Activity, who's, or Jason Blum, you know, these directors and producers of low budget horror films, found footage horror films. I personally think that they're genius because they are able to make so much money at the box office, and yet their films are made for less than $1 million, which is mm-hmm. not a lot of money in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So something like The Blair Witch, they got a lot of publicity. Part of it was because people were scared. People had never seen something like that before mm-hmm. where they're, you know, walking around in the woods, and that could be them. You know, that's part mm-hmm. of the found footage. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing about found footage.
What is found footage?
Found footage is like the concept is you think that this movie could be real. So mm-hmm. a lot of people thought The Blair Witch was real. I mean, that was part of the genius of its marketing campaign. It was a bit of a hoax for a while that some people actually thought that this footage was literally found. Someone's camera had been found and mm-hmm, they mm-hmm. cut all this footage together and released it, which is absurd. Obviously, no one would really do that. Or Catfish was another film that people still, I think, are debating whether it's real or not. But basically, the films that seem like they could have just been found and cut together later, that they really happened, they're real events that were recorded, that's a found footage film.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, so I think the Blair Witch, you know, that got a lot of hype because people had never seen anything like that before. And Hollywood studios saw that film and thought, this is genius. If people are actually scared by a movie that was made for a couple grand by a couple of kids in the woods, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, now that brings us right into the money-making or the business aspect of movies. Now, in your talk last night after the movie, you talked about, and in the movie, you play a character who is among these four main characters, and they're each different kinds of people.
Right.
You were sort of the mother superior or the business person.
Right.
In fact, there's an interesting dialogue that you have with one of your fellow actors about, are you an artist or are you a business person?
Right.
Mix the two for us. Tell us what it's, I'm going to get into what it's like in Hollywood, using that term in the broadest sense. But I want, what about making money? How does that fit in with your artistic desire to create something?
Right. Well, the thing about writing is that it's free and you don't need a lot of money to do it. However, to have anyone ever read it or have anyone want to make your film or see your film, you really do have to have the financial means to get that out there. So, you know, in this day and age with, again, I think I call it the Twitter age or whatever you want to call it, you know, the fact that everything is available online, you can at least get an audience for your material if you're a director or not really a writer, but if you're a director, if you've got film online that people can see, they can access it, and you can get popular there's plenty of people who have become famous just from YouTube. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole viral phenomenon is things can become popular without you having necessarily a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if you know, you want to make a film that people are going to see, it's got to get a little bit of money behind it. And it kind of begins to snowball, you know, once you start getting people interested that are going to invest. And then that means that more people will see the film because it's got higher production value. So Park City, you know, we shot that on a pretty small budget, but people have told me it's got good production value. It seems like we got some good locations and some,
mm-hmm.
And it's believable. I think that's the main thing about production value. It at least has to be believable.
Production value, that's another phrase that we hear now on the out of the movie industry and out of the entertainment industry generally. What is that? How do you define that?
Well, it's what it technically, production value is what the movie looks to be worth. So, you know, if there's special effects and you get some cool explosions and you get some cool, you know, trucks flying off a cliff, that gives your movie a lot of production value. And that's something they really stress in film school, is make the most of your budget. So what they really mean is have the highest production value for
the least amount of money.
Yeah. So get as much, you know, if you have more a crane shot, or you've got a, you know, long tracking shots, that'll add more production value than if you did that same scene shot just, you know, with a couple of static shots. So that's essentially production value. And the more production value a film has, generally the more people, the wider an audience it's going to appeal to. A lot of the superhero films appeal to a really wide audience, partially because there's a lot of fans, there's like already a built-in fan base, but also then, you know, you get guys flying around in suits and they're fighting bad guys, and anybody can watch something like that and be entertained, or that's at least the way that studios, you know,
look at it. Yeah. Well, now you, as a novice, so to speak, which you aren't, we'll talk about that in a minute, but as a novice in film making creation, you have a reason for doing it. Are you going to become rich doing this? Is that what you think?
I will be honest. I didn't get into this business because I want to make money. I know there's money to be made, and I've seen a lot of the houses and a lot of the cars of the successful story creatives. But if I thought I was going to get rich off of doing what I'm doing, I probably would have gotten into a different profession. But there's nothing else I've ever wanted to do. So, that's not really the goal. And I honestly don't even really want to be famous. I see a lot of famous people that seem like they don't particularly enjoy being being on the cover of every magazine or whatever. And I'm not an actress, so it's very unlikely that I would ever attain that kind of fame. But as a writer, you're generally more behind the scenes. But the success comes from getting the most amount of people to see your work, and to, you know, critical acclaim is really the goal, at least for me. I mean, that's where I'd like to end up, is being an artist that becomes a household name. People know my work and people think that it's good. That's really, I don't think it's so exciting to be famous if people think that if you aren't getting great reviews, or, you know, what. That and a lot of successful people start out their career getting bad reviews or making films that people don't think are good, and they got to keep going. And I would be happy to direct a quote unquote bad studio film, you know, in the next few years, because that gives me the great experience. But eventually, the goal is to just make good films.
Good films, yeah. One of the things, talking about money, there are myths abound everywhere about how you're going to make a bunch of money in a particular field. And I have to over and over again to respond to people who think all lawyers are rich. And in fact, there are very few lawyers who make a lot of money, very few. And most of them are struggling along, and if they're honest, and I've seen some of their books, they're making average amount of money, but they're surviving, they're paying for their bills. But the reason that people stay in the law and for long periods of time is there's something about it which resonates with their psyche.
Right.
And they achieve, whether it is they go in and do a great closing argument, and people say, oh, that was wonderful, that was really great, and that gives them the oomph to continue on, or it is some financial reward, or the possibility of financial reward, or I'm known as a great lawyer.
Right.
All of those things. Same thing applies in your business.
Yeah, and I'd say that for me personally, and it's, I guess I'm not really getting to the heart of why I want to do this. It's not just because I want to be known as being a great filmmaker, and it's not just to make money and have a nice house and family someday. It's really at the core of it, because I really want to help people, and I've always been the kind of person that would, since I was a kid, would aspire to do something great that helps people. And, you know, I kind of had a crisis of conscience in the last few years where I thought, well, am I really helping anyone by working in the movie business? I mean, it's a tough business, and there's a lot of harsh critics, and there's a lot of people that are dishonest, and, you know, just in the business itself, and there's a lot of films that I don't think help anybody positively. Mm-hmm. They're just pure popcorn, you know, eating, movie watching experience. But I do believe that art is important to helping our society learn. It has storytelling from the dawn of man has been mm-hmm. one of the most mm-hmm. important things to shaping us as a species, and making us, you know, learn morality and learn, you know, lessons that we carry on from generation to generation. And films inspire people. And even if they're pure entertainment, they are 2 hours of people feeling good and being entertained and possibly being, you know,
educated.
Being educated, right. So, you know, and art has always done that for us. And film is for me the most powerful medium, because it can reach a wide audience. It's not just sound, it's not just picture, it's a combination of the two. You hear voices, you see performances, you go to places you might not be able to go in your real life. So film is essentially, I think, one of the great ways that, you know, and being a storyteller is one of the great ways that you can really help people in a kind of an abstract way.
Movies and movie makers and screenwriters, it seems to me, help to create the culture, and they are the result of the culture. There's a symbiotic relationship
Absolutely.
Between the culture and the creator. And that's why it's always fascinating for me to go to a movie and not only to look at the movie and the people who make it, but rather see how this reflects what's going on in the rest of society.
Right.
And I saw The Lone Ranger. It was a terrible movie.
Yeah.
It was absolutely abysmal. But it did help me to say, you know what? The public is not so stupid as you want to think, because it bombed.
Yep.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
And the reaction was awful.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a break again. We're talking to Hannah Rossner, who is a movie maker, a director, an author, screenwriter, chief cook, and bottle washer for Park City. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back with On With Respect with Hannah Rossner, who is a movie everything for Park City. She is it. Chief cook and bottle washer is the easiest way to say it. And this is John Smetanka. Now, Hannah, when we broke, the magic question that I've been holding off on, how old are you?
I'm 25.
And you've made a movie, you've written a book, and you've made music videos, and you're working a full-time job out in California. Where do you get the energy?
I don't know. I think I just don't feel right if I'm not writing, and it's always been that way. It's kind of just something I need to do, and so it's the energy really comes from just this core ambition that I've always had. And whether or not I have the energy, like, I make time for these things, so, you know, because it's important to me. So I've always been busy. I've just mm-hmm. you know when I was in high school, I was in a million sports, and I was in a million plays, and I was just always had my hands in something. In college, I was also a musician and I was in a band and we went on tour and I had like a completely different life than I do now. But I've always consistently been creating along the way. And I think it's because I can't not. I really can't just take a break from writing. And when I talk
to... It's down deep inside.
Yeah, it's in there, you know. And sometimes I talk to friends of mine who say, you know, I want to be a writer. I just can't find the time. I say, you know, you got to just make the time. That's the only advice
there's
I can give you.
There's a well thought out, a short saying, and that is, if you want a job done, ask a busy person.
Right.
Because they're busy for a reason, mm-hmm. but also they tend to be the ones who can take on a little bit more and get it done,
yeah.
get a job done.
Yeah, you know, you just got to figure out what works for you. And there's a lot of things going on in my life, and I really have to prioritize, and sometimes I have to make tough choices between, you know, am I going to go out with my friends tonight? Am I going to see my boyfriend? Am I going to, you know, go to this, you know, and whatever it is that's happening. I'm a very social person, so I always sometimes wonder how I ended up being a writer, because generally when you think of a writer, you think of someone in their, you know, locked up in their room with their typewriter. But also, to be a writer, you have to experience life and you have to go out and try new things and observe people. So, which is actually something that I call window time. Window time is because I kind of schedule every little moment in my life, even if I don't want to. Sometimes I just have to.
It's compulsive. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you
even,
mean.
Even my free time, I'm like, okay, I have 2 hours to relax, you know, quote unquote. This isn't really relaxing. But, you know, so.
You will relax right now,
right,
Bobby.
Right. Sit down and just watch TV, even if it's bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, window time, it to me is like the time that you spend not writing, just observing and gathering, you know, material and gathering inspiration. And that's something I've really focused on this year, is trying to hone my creative muscle and follow my passion, whatever I think is interesting or different or something that I might want to one day write about, even if it's not that particular subject. It's just, you know, there's new people I'm going to meet or new experiences I'm going to have. So I make time for that kind of thing too. It's not just work all the time.
Yeah.
But
one of the things that in your movie last evening, one of the other areas that you raised was you're bugging your friends to get out and to make contacts.
Right.
And just, you know, you're at a party. You're not here to enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
You're out here to meet people.
Right.
When I was campaigning, I remember the first event I ever campaigned at. My campaign manager watched me. And at the end of the evening, it was a dinner of about 200 people. And I had a great time. I loved it. I had a nice dinner, and I talked to two or three really interesting people. And she came out afterwards, and she says, "What did you do tonight? What did you do?" And I said, "Well, this is a great event." She said, "This was a catastrophe." "Why? How many hands did you shake?" "Well, I shake, you know, 15, 20 people. I talked..." You need to shake every single hand in that room.
Right.
And you had dinner, didn't you? And I said, "Well, yeah, it's a dinner. I'm supposed to." You don't eat at those. That's
right.
Not the purpose for you being
right.
here.
Yeah.
So I turned to you and I say, I watched in that movie. You had friends, your co-stars were talking to other people or hitting on some people that they wanted to spend the night with or whatever.
Right.
And you kept saying, "No. No, no."
we're here for a purpose.
We're here for a purpose.
Yeah.
How much of that do you do in your real life?
I'm pretty terrible at that in real life, actually. I'm more like Joey, I think, in real life or
yeah.
something, I guess. I'm like the creative person just running around trying to have fun and trying to follow the party and find out where what's happening. Because, frankly, that's where I've personally made a lot of my connections is in the less stuffy, I just don't particularly love networking events, but I drag myself to them all the time.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
My friends who work at Hollywood agencies, they generally are the ones that are like, "All right, you got to go to this networking event. You got to meet so and so from Sony and so and so's assistant at, you know, blah 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 company." And I end up meeting people that I love, and it's always a good time. But having the energy after a 12-hour day at work, or after doing, you know, a million mm-hmm. meetings and taking a million notes, going out and networking is exhausting. It's not like exactly like your campaign manager.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly like she said, you're not there to socialize. You're there to talk to someone for a grand total of 3 minutes, figure out where they're, what they do, where they work, what they can do for you, what they can do for you can do for them, and give them your card and move on to the next person. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely exhausting. It's not a good time, but you can meet some great people that either can become your friend or a business associate or a industry contact who you can help and therefore can help you in the future. Mm-hmm. So it is very important, and I do stress to a lot of people that I know that moved to Hollywood and are new, to just go to absolutely every event. And then another thing that confounds my non-Hollywood friends is that I go to drinks like every other night, maybe two or three times a week. I'll go out for drinks or a breakfast or lunch with a new contact or someone that I haven't seen in a while that works mm-hmm. at another production company. And that's just a good way to, you know, to foster those contacts so that, you know, if in a couple weeks I might need a script from their company, they can slip it to me. Or if I need a phone number of the head of their studio for my boss, I can get that. So it's definitely helpful and very important. But me personally, I'm good at it. I know how to do it. I don't really enjoy.
Why do people fail in Hollywood, in movies, and I mean in each of the different realms, not acting or directing or screenwriting or production or whatever it happens they're doing? Why do they fail?
Well, there's two types of failure. There's giving up, which is, in my opinion, the greatest failure. And I'd say, you know, 75% of, if not more, of the people that go to Hollywood looking for a job say, you know what, I'm going to just be here for 4 or 5 years until I sell a script, and then I'm going to take it from there. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll go home and get in advertising. And I say, if that's your attitude, you should probably just go in advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a plan B, I think my mentor actually told me this, you know, if you have a plan B, you should stick with plan B, because you can't, it is going to be a long, hard road, and you don't know how long it's going to take. But eventually, some semblance of success, I do believe, will find you as long as the work is good. So the other kind of failure is if you simply don't have what it takes, if you don't have talent, and I think talent is a really obscure thing. It's very abstract. You know, you can have raw natural talent, but writing is a craft. It's not just something that you know how to do. There are some people that are just naturally good at it, but you still need to learn how to format a screenplay. You still need to learn three-act structure. You still need to learn how to transition. All of these things you can learn every day if you want to, or, you know, for the rest of your life. And so if you don't keep learning, your work is not going to get better, and you're inevitably going to fail, because people can tell, studio executives can tell, if you know what you're talking about, if you've seen the same kind of film to the one that you're pitching, or if you've really thought through your main character's through line, or if you've really thought through the premise of your film, or if you just came up with it and decided, you know, I'm going to go to this meeting and I'll just wing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people can tell that sort of thing. So you have to be a hard worker. That answers your question.
Mm-hmm, it does.
A lot of things.
It does. In my world of politics and law, there are a number of different things that cause failure. One is that they really don't belong there. That is, their interests are superficial
right.
in what they're doing, and they don't take it seriously. Another reason is because they get tired, and something happens in their lives that just crashes them. A third one is substance abuse. I've seen a lot of people in politics and in the law that they drink their lunch
mm-hmm.
and or they snort cocaine and they kill themselves.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, it really, they're distracted. They've got a plan B, but they've also got a plan C
sure.
and a plan D.
Sure.
And all of those things to distract from achieving what you want to do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hannah Rossner, this was great. Thank you very much. We've been talking here to Hannah Rossner, who is the director, the playwright, the screenwriter for the movie Park City. And as I usually say, we can't tell people to go out and take a look at it, but if you have the opportunity, it's a worthwhile hour and 25 minutes or 30 minutes. Well done, you.
Thank you. Very yes, good. And you can check out the film on Facebook. And Twitter. We're facebook.com/ParkCityTheMovie. Or parkcitythemovie.com.
And now, do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes. I primarily am using the Park City website right now, parkcitythemovie.com. We're also on IMDb. I have a website, but it's really out of date.
Okay.
So, got to update that.
Thank you very much. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And remember, our mantra is, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.